American poets, particularly about the way they write and think about nature, the natural world. It seemed a natural topic for Holden, since we talk about the creation around us here quite a bit and we can't avoid thinking about it. I'm going to make some general comments, which I always suffer from a tendency to be a little bit oversimplified about American poetry and the attitude toward nature in it. But in order to do anything in an hour, we have to do that. And I'm going to use Frost as an example of what I mean. I'm going to mention a few other people. Though Frost is an individual and doesn't exactly represent everybody, I think he represents the particular things I'm going to say about American poetry fairly well. I also want to preface this by saying, by no means will this be a complete picture of Frost either. He's a complex poet who wrote a great deal of poetry and we don't have time to look at it all. But with that apology aside, I'll go ahead. And I would like to encourage any of you who have some favorite poets or poems to feel free to contribute your feelings about those things to the conversation, and or to offer those poems to us if you have them committed to memory, as many of us do have an occasional poem here there that we like very much. And this morning we went on a poetry hike with five people. We walked through the woods and read some poetry and recited some poetry, and it was delightful that a number of the people on the hike had some poems committed to memory and shared them, or pieces of poems that certain things reminded them of, and that was fun. So if that kind of thing happens to you, by all means, please contribute that. We're a small enough group that we can do that. We can make this a little bit like a conversation, and not too much like a lecture if I can get done saying what I want to say. So cut me off. I'm going to make the general observations first. The first two great American poets who shaped the attitude particularly toward nature in American poetry were Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman, both writing about the middle of the 19th century. And they have absolutely opposite ways of writing poetry and of looking at nature. It's very interesting. And Whitman particularly was a kind of a landmark in American poetry, and everyone who has written since that time about nature has had to contend with Whitman's position. Whitman was called by literary scholars a transcendentalist, strongly influenced by Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, who are famous outside the realm of poetry as well as, you know, as poets. And Whitman's position, I guess I could say, is that everything in the world was one. All of the creation was unified, was one. That kind of idea that we have heard a great deal these days was a radical new break from the English tradition in poetry, and a new thing for America at the time. Of course, Emerson was kicked out of his church for preaching such things. I think that was what resulted in the Unitarian Church. But I don't want to get into that. Whitman, at any rate, wrote poems that were celebrations of the whole natural order and an inclusion of himself in that, in a sense that everything was one and everything was beautiful. A very simple but energetic affirmation, and it's wonderful poetry to read. I don't have any here because most of his poems are about 30 pages long, and he just, he's very exuberant, and he gets very excited about about the oneness of all things. And that's the background against which most other poets have written. Emily Dickinson, at the same time, was writing very short, concise observations of particular things in nature, and also lots of psychological and spiritual truths. Her method was as an observer, clearly looking at something in the natural world, possibly learning something, but primarily observing. Quite different from being one with it, kind of transmitting yourself into it. And almost all the American poets since the time of Whitman have had to consider that idea that we are one with nature, and almost all of them have rejected the idea and have come to some kind of compromise or some kind of position whereby they recognize a difference between human beings and the natural order, the non-human natural order. I know that comes as a bit of a surprise, but came as a surprise to me too when I started to read all this poetry and discovered that real distance that almost all of these poets felt between themselves and the natural world. I want to read a poem by a contemporary poet named A.R. Ammons, who is a professor at Cornell University and won the Pulitzer Prize for his collected poems in 1971, I believe. Still writing, of course. He spent much of his energy in his early poetry, still is interested in this, trying to understand what his relationship was to nature. This has always been an important subject for Americans because of the immensity and the wildness of our continent here. And, you know, as opposed to the European experience, where the world was pretty much domesticated by the time people started to write poetry, at least the poetry we read, here we had a wild continent opening up, and the relationship of people to that natural order was very important. This is a complicated poem, and don't worry about it if you don't like it, but it does exemplify this thing I'm talking about. The poet talks about a process in which he tried to identify everything in, or all his feelings and himself with things in the natural world. Many of his poems are like that. He always feels that it doesn't work completely, and that it, and this poem illustrates that quite well. It's called For Harold Bloom. It's addressed to a critic of poetry who's a friend of his. I went to the summit and stood in the high nakedness. The wind tore about this way and that in confusion, and its speech could not get through to me, nor could I address it. Still, I said, as if to the alien in myself, I do not speak to the wind now, for having been brought this far by nature, I have been brought out of nature, and nothing here shows me an image of myself. For the word tree, I have been shown a tree, and for the word rock, I have been shown a rock. For stream, for cloud, for star, this place has provided firm implication and answering, but where here is the image for longing? So I touched the rocks, their interesting crusts. I flaked the bark of stunt fir. I looked into space and into the sun, and nothing answered my word, longing. Goodbye, I said. Goodbye, nature so grand and reticent. Your tongues are healed up into their own element. And as you have shut up, you have shut me out. I am as foreign here as if I had landed, a visitor. So I went back down and gathered mud and with my hands made an image for longing. I took the image to the summit. First I set it here on the top rock, but it completed nothing. Then I set it there among the tiny firs, but it would not fit. So I returned to the city and built a house to set the image in. And men came to my house and said, that is an image for longing. And nothing will ever be the same again. The last line suggests that for the poet, he has learned that there are certain things that are not answered in nature. There are certain human experiences which cannot be associated with nature, and uses the word longing as his example of that. And so that the The way you find the image for longing is not to look at the mountain, but to look at human reality, to make it yourself, to put it in a house, in a city, all those human things. And it illustrates the separation or difference that he feels between people and nature. The Puritan preachers who were responsible for a lot of the influence on American literature tended to think that in the natural world, in storms, for instance, they found messages from God, revelations of the nature of God, the mood of God. And so often physical circumstances of the natural world were interpreted, used as sermon illustrations. And we still do this today, of course. They make good sermon illustrations. That is to suggest that the natural world tells us something about our spirits and about the nature of God. Most modern American poets don't feel they get a message from the natural world. Not only do they not identify with it, but they don't really feel the natural world teaches me something about myself. Again, that's a little bit of a surprise, but when you look at their poems, I think that's what you see. It is not to say that they do not love to be there, that they don't enjoy it, that they don't find it beautiful, but it is to say that the natural world is about the natural world. It's about non-human things, and human beings are somehow special, different, because of the imaginations they have, and so forth. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Frost. And I'm going to say, I think, three major things about Frost. They may not all seem directly related to this. The first is that we all know the image, the normal image about Frost is that he is a poet who loves nature, who lives in the natural world, chose to live in New Hampshire on a farm, and writes lovingly about his experiences there. That's certainly true. There is another side to Frost's attitude toward nature and his poetry, which was shockingly revealed, in a way, all at once, it seems, to the public in a speech by Lionel Trilling given at Frost's 80th birthday. There was a kind of a public national birthday party for Frost, and this great literary critic was invited to speak. And he spoke about the fear of nature in Robert Frost. And everybody said, what? What do you mean, the fear of nature? Of course, they looked back at the poems and Trilling was right. But it was a kind of thing that people had overlooked because what they liked in Frost's poetry was the love of nature.
Well, you should tell us that the dinner for Frost's birthday was at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. And everyone came and was all dressed up, and it was a very special occasion for this beloved poet of America. Trilling started saying this stuff, that Robert Frost was really talking about the darkness and the fear in American culture. People started to boo and hiss and throw food.
I didn't know.
It really was so shocking that people responded from their guts about this, and these dressed up New York socialites just and literary critics couldn't handle this new insight that Trilling had.
Was Frost there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, did he know how to be? Well, he's a very quiet, ironic fellow, and I think he just accepted the award. And
I often wondered whether Trilling was confusing fear with awe.
Yeah, I think there's a little of both. I'll read you some poems that And you can decide whether you think it's more awe or more fear.
Because there's very fearful about deciding on my own. I expect to have a benefit.
You expect me to tell you. That's not the way it works. I'm going to read the poems, and you have to think about it. Yeah, I'll give you my impressions, I guess. Christine said that he's an ironic poet. That's the first thing I want to mention about Frost. He has his tongue in cheek a lot of the time. And I just want to tell you an anecdote about one of Frost's most famous poems, The Road Not Taken, This is the poem, Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood. You've all heard that, and many of us have had posters on our walls that said, "And I took the road less traveled by," and that's made all the difference. Frost used to go visit a friend of his in New Hampshire and go for walks. And this friend had insatiable curiosity about paths, and he used to take Frost out in the woods, and Frost would be in the mood for wandering around for a half hour and going back to the fireside and having a cup of tea, and this guy would say, "There's a path I've never been down. Let's go down there." You know, pretty soon they'd be pushing the brambles aside and crawling, and Frost used to give this guy a hard time about it, always taking him down these paths, unused paths that were of no use to anybody and obviously had been abandoned because they went into swamps or whatever, you know. So he wrote this poem and sent it to this man. Now here's the poem. I don't mean, incidentally, by mentioning this anecdote, to say that those who have found this poem moving should feel badly and rip it off their walls and throw it away. It's just that Frost may not have found in it what we find in it, and that's fine. I think I'd be fine with Frost. I think he's quite happy about the way most people felt about it. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as justice fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though, as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if ever I should come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Notice, incidentally, that there isn't much difference between the roads, as he says. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden back. Really isn't much difference between the paths. If you want to keep that anecdote in mind, Frost really probably had his tongue in cheek when he wrote this poem about how much difference it made, because he's kidding his friend about this habit that he has about always taking him down these back roads. There's some more obvious examples, and let's see. This is kind of a fun poem called Once by the Pacific. The shattered water made a misty din. Great waves looked over others coming in and thought of doing something to the shore the water never did to land before. The clouds were low and hairy in the skies, like locks blown forward in the gleam of eyes. You could not tell, and yet it looked as if the shore was lucky in being backed by cliff, the cliff in being backed by continent. It looked as if a night of dark intent was coming, and not only a night, an age. Someone had better be prepared for rage. There would be more than ocean water broken before God's last put out the light was spoken. Frost is describing a storm coming on, and you can hear him having fun, kind of this idea of God's last put out the light. How enraged this storm looked and personified with this hairy gleam of eyes and so forth. Different kind of irony before I do something a little different. He was often ironic about human pretensions, and that's what this poem is about, called On a Tree Fallen Across the Road, subtitled To Hear Us Talk. The tree the tempest with a crash of wood throws down in front of us is not to bar our passage to our journey's end for good, but just to ask us who we think we are, insisting always on our own way so. She likes to halt us in our runner tracks and make us get down in a foot of snow, debating what to do without an axe. And yet she knows obstruction is in vain. We will not be put off the final goal we have it hidden in us to attain, not though we have to seize earth by the pole and, tired of aimless circling in one place, steer straight off after something into space. That image of people grabbing the world by the pole and steering it off is obviously one of not letting God's order prevail, but trying to take everything into our own hands. And sometimes, Frost feels, that's what human beings do. So that every once in a while nature will drop a tree across the road to remind them. It doesn't work, though, we feel, Frost saying, we're all so pretentious about our abilities to overcome these things. Yes?
I wonder if everyone heard irony in that last previous poem about the sea storm.
Okay.
I mean, everyone's flipping me.
Yeah, no, I... How about it? Did I push that by too fast?
No.
It's not irony of this. You heard the irony in this on a tree falling across the room. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
There's nothing to thank me for.
No, you're not obtuse at all. I just, it means that I was, got to be aware of these things. I think it's a little ironic in the sense that he is exaggerating things. It's in a way a frightening image of a storm. Pardon?
For me, it seems to set the mood of a storm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe my mood, pretentious storms, is an exaggerated mood. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's when I get to before God's last put out the light was spoken, the suggestion that this storm is somehow related to the end of the world. I don't know. I appreciate your saying that. I don't think it's obvious at all. It's not obvious.
The storm, to me, is pictured as late in the evening, and God has last put out the light. It's the last fading glimmer of daylight disappearing for the night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway.
Yeah. Okay. That may not have been a good choice because it isn't anything like these other ones in being obviously tongue in cheek, and maybe I'm the only one who sees it that way.
Well, how about that part about waste crashing on the shore, it's a good thing there's a cliff behind that, it's a good thing there's this whole continent behind that.
Yeah.
That's kind of funny, cheeky.
Yeah. It's certainly bordering on exaggeration, if it isn't.
We should choose
the side. No, right. Okay. Well, that's kind of what I was feeling in it, too. A different kind of irony, and it's questionable whether you'd call it irony. But there's a more important thing I want to talk about here, and that's Frost's fear. Of the natural world. So let me just read a couple of poems that I think illustrate that. The third thing I want to say about Frost, I was going to do second, but I'm not sure I've got time, that's why I'm going to skip it for now, is his attitude toward receiving messages from nature, what you can learn from nature. He's got a kind of mixture of poems on that subject, and he's quite interested in that subject, I think. Maybe I'll get back to it on time. Just want to read a few things about that I think illustrate the fear of nature. This first one is called Bereft. A lot of these poems set in a New Hampshire winter. Where had I heard this wind before change like this to a deeper roar? What would it take my standing there for, holding upon a restive door, looking downhill to a frothy shore? Summer was past and day was past, somber clouds in the west were massed. Out on the porch's sagging floor, leaves got up in a coil and hissed, blindly struck at my knee and missed. Something sinister in the tone told me my secret must be known. Word I was in the house alone somehow must have gotten abroad. Word I was in my life alone. Word I had no one left but God.
Well, there's a leaves bit. I can see the corner of the porch
yeah, hissing over there. And that's how he thinks of it. He doesn't say they're rustling in the corner. In this case, they're hissing. Maybe a momentary fear or even a dream, you know, where suddenly the natural world seems evil, seems out to get you.
The hissing reminds you right away of snakes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As if somehow the word's gotten out that he is helpless tonight. He doesn't have people around him until the punchline. He does have God. An unusual thing for Frost to say, incidentally. But in that poem, he's feeling some strength in that. Another poem in a similar vein, Storm Fear, it's called. When the wind works against us in the dark and pelts with snow the lower chamber window on the east and whispers with a sort of stifled bark, the beast, come out, come out! It costs no inward struggle not to go. Ah, no. I count our strength, two and a child, those of us not asleep, subdued, to mark how the cold creeps as the fire dies at length, how drifts are piled, dooryard and road ungrated, till even the comforting barn grows far away, and my own heart owns a doubt whether 'tis in us to arise with day and save ourselves unaided.
Why save ourselves unaided? Now, all through that poem, I was feeling that he was fearful of nature. And that last line, sort of a bit of a pantheism in that last line, save ourselves unaided, that unless we are saved by a superior force, we cannot be saved.
Right.
There's awe in that line, surely.
Yeah. Although you say pantheism, it sounds to me like he might be looking again to God for the aid or to other human beings for the aid, rescue service,
yeah,
you know.
Rather than aid in nature itself. That's
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. We haven't had anything yet that would indicate what his picture of God is.
No.
Yeah, right at the end, he's asking a question whether he should or we should look to whether we're going to get any aid or something for them.
Yeah.
Really state how he's feeling.
Yeah, it says, my heart owns a doubt whether 'tis in us to arise with day and save ourselves unaided. Yeah, he begins to wonder, can we really survive this? And of course it happens at night in the cold. But you notice the way that nature is personified here again as a kind of antagonist. The wind works against us in the dark. It whispers with a sort of stifled bark, the beast referring to the wind again. Come out, come out. As if he's being taunted to come out and fight, you know. And Frost, once in a while, feels that way. One more here. Even more obvious, I think, in this sense of the kind of antagonistic relationship between the natural world, other than humans and people. The times table, this is called.
Can I just ask a question? Do you think it's an antagonism as such, or the human being out of place in the natural realm? Do you see that we're the only ones who are antagonized by that, because everything else has a way of surviving, and except for us, we have to have the help of something else or some force greater than we.
Mm-hmm.
I am reminded of that after having spent one of the worst winters in South Dakota that they've had in 70 years.
Uh-huh.
And it's more than awe, but it's fear at the uncontrollable aspect of the weather.
Yeah.
You know, that it does seem at times to be out to kill you, and it will return once again to prairie with no sign of life at all, and that is indeed the natural order, without the infringement of human beings.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm
getting at? Yeah. Is it that people are alien? That is just out of place there, or is there really a
so
battle?
It's not a malicious antagonism.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's, you know, if you ask Frost in a rational moment, he would say at worst it's that we are alien and a little bit out of place here. He'd say more likely we belong in there, kind of interacting. Mm-hmm. But in his moments of fear, it seems to him that nature is out to get him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's precisely at those times when it seems so powerful that he can't control it, you know. So that's an emotional truth, that antagonism. It isn't so much what he would say intellectually, I don't think.
It just strikes me that even in South Dakota, and I was thinking of this winter the same way, it isn't so much an alien as it is perhaps that we aren't very powerful. We aren't nearly as powerful as we think we are. In other words, yeah. We think we are the end all. We are not. We are only one little part. And nature, anytime they wants to, can crunch us.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that.
And you sort of lure into that powerful feeling when the weather is, you know, decent or okay, but it doesn't. It's not like that all the time. You know?
Right. Yeah. And he's quite aware of that. You know, when he's making fun of human pretension, as he does in that on the tree falling across the road, he's aware of how easy it is for us to feel we're completely in control. And then he also recognizes this other side when we're afraid. This one, not a great poem, but I think it illustrates this one thing. The Times Table. Not a great poem, but I think it illustrates this one thing. The Times Table. More than halfway up the path was a spring with a broken drinking glass. And whether the farmer drank or not, his mare was sure to observe the spot by trampling the wheel on water bars, turning her forehead with a star, and straining her ribs for a monster sigh. To which the farmer would make reply, "A sigh for every so many breaths, and for every so many sigh breaths." That's what I always tell my wife, is the multiplication table of life. The same may be ever so true, but it's just the kind of thing that you, nor I, nor anybody else may say, unless our purpose is being harmed. And then I know of no better way to close a road, abandon a farm, reduce the birth of the human race, and bring back nature in people's place. Yeah, the center section was the saying of the farmer. If he hears the horse sigh and says, "A sigh for every so many breaths, and for every so many sigh a death." That's what I always tell my wife, is the multiplication table of life. Well, Frost is right. That's a pretty grim way of looking at life. But the way he concludes this poem, "Bring back nature in people's place," suggests the kind of relationship that Americans have often had with nature. There it was. Human beings arrived and had to hack out a farm, cut down the trees, root up the stumps, and kind of take over. Had to conquer that space and make themselves a place. And what can happen if we don't keep the right attitude is that nature will come back as if there's this kind of interaction going on. Yeah.
I see this like driving through South Dakota. You see all these
empty
homesteads where people have spent their whole life building it up, and now the grass is coming back in, they're falling down. And you just, it's just like that struggle has taken over, and now nature's claiming it back.
Yeah.
That's just the feeling I got when I drove through there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a feeling you get when you go out to the old Holden
Miner's
Village. Mm-hmm. If, especially, you know, I never had a chance to see what it looked like before. But it was, I just saw a couple photographs the other night when a couple of men from that village were here and had photographs of it. Looked like a town, looked like a little European town. Walkways, a nice stone, you can see the stone walls and the stone staircases. And now it's just, looks just about, with the exception of those few stones around and a couple of old tin things you find in there, looks like the rest of this wilderness. Frost has a good poem about that particular thing that I'm going to read. Yeah.
In a sense, he limits nature, doesn't he? Because man is completely unnatural. And sometimes the wildest part of nature is the animal and man.
Uh-huh.
But man to him is not nature at all.
Well, man is a distinct, if man is part of nature, man is distinct from the trees, the wilderness in it. Yeah, he does
but
seem...
But no sense of being distinct within, and that man is also an animal.
No.
And
no.
Sense of that.
No, that's right. He doesn't really, and in that sense, it's a limitation of humans, I think. Humans are not, to him, he doesn't think of that part of humans that we think of as the same as nature, instinctive. He is always aware of the consciousness of human beings and therefore of their separation or difference from their. The next poem is a good illustration of that, and it's exactly about abandoned farmsteads. I wasn't going to read it now, but it's such a nice poem. I'm going to, since we're talking about it. This is called The Need of Being Versed in Country Things. And what the poem is about is the different perception that the animals, that is, that what I've been calling the natural world, and this speaker, this person, have of an abandoned farmhouse. The house, and it begins with a description of the house having burned down. The house had gone to bring again to the midnight sky a sunset glow. Now the chimney was all of the house that stood, like a pistol after the petals go. The barn opposed across the way that would have joined the house in flame had it been the will of the wind was left to bear forsaken the place's name. No more it opened with all one end for teams that came by the stony road to drum on the floor with scurrying hoofs and brush the mow with the summer load. The birds that came to it through the air at broken windows flew out and in, their murmur more like the sigh we sigh from too much dwelling on what has been. Yet for them the lilac renewed its leaf and the aged elm, though touched with fire, and the dry pump flung up an awkward arm, and the fence post carried a strand of wire. For them there was really nothing sad, but though they rejoiced in the nest they kept, one had to be versed in country things not to believe the Phoebes wept. Phoebes are the birds he's referring to. One had to be versed in country things not to believe the Phoebes wept. The human tendency is to look at that scene and be saddened by it, to believe those birds are sighing and weeping. But the birds don't feel this way about it. For them, the lilac renewed its leaf, the dry pump flung up an awkward arm for them to sit on. For them, there was nothing sad. They rejoiced in the nest they kept. That's the real distinction, again, between the natural order, which is always aware of the continuity, and the human, which is somehow alien from that. Maybe doesn't quite
work. Addressing the absence of man.
Yeah.
Right. Also woman.
Yeah, I've been letting that slip, haven't I, a few times. Don't like to use the word man that way. You should tell me when I'm doing it. Okay, what other... I'm just going to read one more poem, I guess. It's one of my favorite Frost poems. It's called Design, and it's about... Frost walks along one day and finds a little spider, a little white flower called a heal-all, which is ordinarily blue, but in this case is white, and a moth. And you can just see him going for a morning walk and bending down and finding this little scene, in a way, and starting to think about it.
Earlier,
Ernie Zorb. Right. Exactly. Okay. And he asks some interesting questions at the end about what causes all this. Design. I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white heel-all, holding up a moth, like a white piece of rigid satin cloth. Assorted characters of death and blight, mixed ready to begin the morning rite, like the ingredients of a witch's broth. A snowdrop spider, a flower like a froth, and dead wings carried like a paper kite. What had that flower to do with being white, the wayside blue and innocent heel-all? What brought the kindred spider to that height, then steered the white moth thither in the night? What but design of darkness to appall, if design govern in a thing so small? Let me read that last section over again, where he asks the question, what are these three white things particularly white, especially since the flower is supposed to be blue. What are the three white things doing together? And notice that he's called them characters of death and blight, you know, not the things we normally associate with whiteness. What had that flower to do with being white, the wayside blue and innocent heal all? What brought the kindred spider to that height, then steered the white moth thither in the night? What but design of darkness to appall, if design govern in a thing so small? And the reason I like this poem, it's full of kind of twists and ambiguity, but at the end there, if design govern in a thing so small, what is that question? Is it, can God or can whatever orders the universe design be concerned with such small things? And shouldn't they be insignificant? Or is there a second question in the back of Frost's mind? If there is some design mixing these little tiny things of death and blight, you know, even though they appear innocent and they appear white, what kind of control is there on me? That's a kind of secondary, underlying question in there. And I'm not sure how, you know, if Frost finds this particularly frightening, he might be playing a little game with us, but he does make it into a kind of a frightening configuration of things, yeah.
Is he possibly implying that he can escape the design because he thinks the difference is true?
I don't know. I don't know if we get a feeling for how, for his insignificance in this, but maybe if design govern in a thing so small, maybe then design won't govern me either. Yeah, yeah. You get that feeling, and of course, it's almost a rhetorical question there. What but design of darkness? And of course, he sets it up as a design of darkness to appall us, to frighten us. Sorry, appall is a funny word there because it means to make white, to make us pallid. To give us a pallor, that's what a pall comes, it's the same root as those other words. And so in a way, he's not only talking about how appalled we are that these figures are white, but the design of darkness to appall, to make these things white. It's a nice pun, really. Well, I've made this claim that this is not unusual for American poetry to find a real distinction between a human being and a natural world. And I'd just kind of like to hear some responses. If you know poets or poems that come to your mind that seem to suggest the opposite or something different, it'd be good to hear about that, because I know I've given a kind of one-sided view. On the other hand, if you think this is true to your own experience, maybe that's interesting to talk about too. Any comments?
Going back to your comment on appall, I thought I get another kind of pun of it, that the black pall that's put on all of us at the end, the black metallic.
Oh, and that's a pall. Yeah.
You're in pall.
Good, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Good, thank you. I'd never thought of that before. But. Do any of you have favorite Frost poems that you would like to read, or you'd like me to read? I've got a batch of them here. We can do that too.
Yeah. Well, I can't help but think, looking at this Robert Frost, the Robinson Jeffers, the California, the recent poet, I can't help but think that he must have read a bit of Frost, that he was influenced or inspired by him in his own poetry. Of course, he carried it to a lot sort of further, more bitter actual denunciation of man.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Robinson Jeffers. You, you and I are the only people I know of who have associated Robert Frost and Robinson Jefferson. But I think you're right. I read a lot of American poets when I was doing a study of American poetry and the poet's relationship to nature in graduate school. And I ended up concentrating on this man, A.R. Ammons, Robert Frost, and Robinson Jefferson. Because I felt they were in the mainstream and they addressed themselves to certain questions I was interested in, and they're very similar in some ways. I only had one Robinson Jefferson poem with me, and it's up in my room. It's called Shine, Perishing Republic, in which he expresses a quite cynical feeling about about America, yeah, and also about human nature.
Yeah, America, the states of the next age will remember you and edge their love of freedom with contempt of luxury.
Might be out of the same, out of that poem, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I do think there's a connection. Yeah. Other comments?
It's interesting that you should put those two poets together, because I was just sitting here wondering how different Robert Frost's poetry would be if he lived in Southern California, where the weather seems to be more gentle the time,
mm-hmm,
instead of so fierce. I imagine tropical storms in the ocean have tremendous power.
Mm-hmm. You might have something very fearful out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not talking about Los Angeles sprawl or smog, yeah, or anything like that.
Or urban sprawl, or,
yes,
or earthquakes.
Yeah.
Or McDonald's hamburgers.
Life in California isn't easy, I think.
It depends on what kind of California.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're
very
sunny.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, we have to go now. That I think the fear in Frost is not brought about primarily by the violence of nature, but by his sense of somehow being alien from it and not quite belonging there. And that's the thing that it's often revealed in his poems, and some of the poems I read, by because you've got cold winter and the snow piling up and so forth. But when the leaves are just whirling in the corner, you know, that's not so frightening until you start hearing it as a hiss. There is a sense in which I think it's not the immense power of nature, but just his sense that he's not quite he's not together with it. In fact, sometimes there's a kind of antagonism. I couldn't find the one poem I wanted most for that, but yeah.
Did he write anything about, well, the only way man becomes nature is to die and to be decompose? Does he write anything about that?
I don't think so. There are other people who would write that way.
Yeah, I was just wondering if he takes it that way.
Yeah.
Nature.
No, I don't think that I recall anything like that in Frost. That would be more like a the transcendentalist approach, I think. What's his name? Dylan Thomas, for instance, would probably agree with that. You re-enter the cycle of the world when your body decays, but not Frost. Yeah, and in fact, Dylan Thomas, of course, is an English poet. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.